Good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to see so many people here, despite the rather uncivilized hour. But on point, I have to blame Tom for this time slot. Aaron gave Tom the option of the 7:15 or the 8 a.m. on a first-come, first-served basis. And I think Tom just sort of hummed and hawed, so BC Assessment took the more coveted 8 a.m. session. So thanks very much for that, Tom.
No, they were very rude and just jumped in.
Okay.
We got right back.
Anyhow, I really, what I find quite clever this morning is I love the title of the presentation this morning, Policy Trumps Spin, Managing Public's Expectations. I think it's very timely, and quite like that, Tom. In any event, I hope you all had some breakfast on the way in. If not, the buffet is going to be open till 8:30, so get it on your way out. And to start, I'd like to acknowledge that we're conducting our business today on the traditional territory of the Musqueam First Nation and the Coast Salish peoples. We're here this morning to talk about communication strategies, specifically how an inadequate or haphazard communication strategy can get your local government into trouble by fostering unrealistic public expectations. Tom Barnes and Megan Charlton of the Municipal Insurance Association are going to share some real-life examples of kinds of trouble we're talking about and how to avoid or resolve those situations. Allow me to introduce them both to you. Tom Barnes has been the CAO and General Counsel for MIABC since 2005. The Municipal Insurance Association of BC is a reciprocal insurance exchange licensed to provide liability insurance to BC local governments. Founded in 1987 with 144 subscribers, it now provides coverage to 172 members representing 90% of BC's local governments. Megan Charlton is Assistant General Counsel and Director of Member Services at MIABC. She is responsible for overseeing the provision of risk management services, property appraisals, the casual legal advice program, the MIABC's publications and other member services initiative. Megan also assists MIA's General Counsel in overseeing in-house legal department. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome Tom and Megan.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm going to wander around this stage until that light isn't directly in my eyes, because it's tough driving enough with the snow out there without that spot in my face. We are going to talk about policy today. That's the first word of the title of our... You know what? I remember this squeaky stage from last year. That's the first word in the title of our presentation. And it's something you hear us talk about a lot. But what we're talking about is what are the core things that local government does is formulate policy. And policy does more than avoid claims. Policy can help you avoid trouble, even if there's no insurance-related problems and there's no liability. What you're going to find out today is policy is what the law gives local governments the opportunity to write their own get-out-of-jail-free card for almost any circumstance. And it's the most powerful tool you have, and we're going to tell you just a little bit about it and how to develop it. But first, the title of when you want to manage public expectations, your gut reaction, your initial response is going to be tell people what they want to hear. And that's what they call spin. And that's where you could get into trouble. And so we didn't realize, so we actually prepared this before the inauguration, so we didn't realize that there was this double meaning about the second word there. So, but Megan has taken it to the next concept. We're putting claims in their place.
Because we are with the Municipal Insurance Association, we often talk about policy as a great risk management strategy to avoid claims. And managing public expectation can be a great risk management strategy to implement to do three things. One, to reduce your liability exposure for claims. Because if you're not making promises to people that you can't keep, and that they're relying on to their detriment, that you're not going to have that exposure for negligent misrepresentation claims. Secondly, by managing public expectations, you are you're reducing the likelihood that you're going to receive these claims. Because when you make promises to people, or you raise their expectations and you can't meet those expectations, people get mad. And sometimes when people get mad, they want to sue you, or they want to make a claim against the local government. So keeping those expectations realistic can also help to reduce the likelihood that you're going to get claims. And thirdly, it can also assist you in helping to manage those claims. We're going to talk today about and share some examples where we've had staff and elected officials really empathize with claimants who have suffered a loss and make promises to them that they're going to make them whole. And that may not necessarily be the case. And that can result in a very rocky claim and one that's very difficult to resolve.
All right, so we'll just begin by talking just a little bit about who the Municipal Insurance Association is. We did a very careful review of those who are registered for the program today for two reasons. One was to find out how many of you own us. And the answer is, unless you're from the Capital Regional District, the Caribou Regional District, the Central Okanagan Regional District, or the Islands Trust, you own the Municipal Insurance Association of BC. So that's well over 90% of you. We provide all of you that, other than those five I mentioned, we provide your liability insurance, and almost half of the rest of you, we provide all the insurance other than ICBC insurance that that your local government has. So we are your insurance company, and when I say we are your insurance company, I don't mean we are a service provider. I mean you own an insurance company, and we provide you insurance, and yes, you get all the benefits of ownership. You tell us the coverage that we give you, and we provide it. And when we accidentally make money, yes, we give you dividends back. So that's who we are. So unless you're one of those five, you're part of the club. And if you're one of those five, it's fine. We don't mind you learning a little bit about the good things we do for everybody else in the province here. So what we are is we provide liability coverage. So if somebody gets hurt and sues a municipality, or somebody suffers property damage and sues a municipality, or somebody suffers economic loss, largely involving construction, or they always seem to involve either construction or property development, and sues a local government. By the terms of your insurance policy, we take over that claim and we deal with it for you. We also provide up to $40 million of coverage per claim. And then for the last 2 years, we've been providing all the property and ancillary coverage that our members want us to provide. And that program has taken off, and it's very firmly established, too. So Megan's now going to tell you what we do.
So aside from responding and handling liability and property claims, one of the real benefits of owning your own insurance reciprocal is the member services that come along with it. So we facilitate non-claim related legal advice, and this is through our casual legal advice program. So our lawyers, we have an in-house counsel staff of four lawyers that defend claims, but we found that we were often getting questions from our members asking for legal advice with respect to issues that weren't the subject of the claim. And we'd love to help our members out, and we really want to provide our expertise and information. But we simply can't give legal advice for any other issue other than with respect to the defense of a claim. But rather than turning our members away and saying, you know what, sorry, you're just going to have to call your municipal solicitor, we created this program called the Casual Legal Advice Program, where our members can subscribe for a fee of between $250 and $750 per year. And that entitles them to access to our third-party service provider, Lidstone & Company. You can call them or email them as many times as you want during the year or on as many issues as you want during the year and get 30 minutes of free legal advice. If your issue takes more than 30 minutes, then they have some preferred rates. So it's really for those kind of quick and dirty questions that you need quick answers to and have to do with a legal issue concerning the local government, not a personal legal issue. We also provide loss control services. So we do things like we provide complimentary facility inspections where we have a third-party service provider that will come out. You indicate what facilities or what local government facilities you want inspected, and our inspectors will come out and provide a detailed report of issues, liability issues that they might see in those facilities. And then you can use our risk management grant program to finance addressing some of these issues. So they might go to a recreation center and note, you know what, you've got a loose handrail here, you've got some sidewalk differentials in the entrance, the tiles in your change room aren't slip resistant, and these are some recommendations that you might want to change to reduce your liability exposure, and then you can pay for those through your risk management grant. And then we also provide risk management education and training. So we have a monthly webinar series. We have monthly newsletters. We've also got our annual risk management conference that's taking place in April of this year. And then we also travel out to our members and we speak to councils and boards and staff. We do regional seminars where we pull staff from a bunch of our members together. And we'll do sessions on coverage, on risk management, on liability exposure. Basically, you can pitch any idea that you want, and we'll consider whether we can do it. In fact, in a couple of months, we're working with one of our legal defense firms to do a mock trial for the Public Works Department out in Richmond to demonstrate why you want to make sure you're documenting your work and what can happen. What's the worst case scenario if you have to go to trial and you haven't properly followed your policy and documented that you followed your policy?
Okay, so we've told you who we are and we've told you what we do. And now I'll tell you why we do it. We do it because we were formed by the UBCM to contribute to the financial stability of local governments in BC 30 years ago. And we do that by providing broad, comprehensive insurance coverage and risk management services at rates that are as low as they can be, as long as we can keep them stable. And why did the UBCM want us to do that? It wasn't so much to save you money as to give you the freedom to decide what you want to do that you think is best for you, your community, without worrying about lawyers and insurance companies telling you you can't do it. You want to put in a playground at a civic park? We never tell you not to do it. We'll tell you how to go about doing that in a way that's going to minimize your risk. And if you get a claim because of that playground equipment that somebody gets hurt, we will take care of it, and we do that for a reasonable cost that's not a major component of a financial component of your budget. So that's why we do it. We do it for the so that you could do what's best for your communities. So now we'll get to how. What's the best way to manage public expectations? Well, did everybody here ever watch American Idol? Come on, somebody watched American Idol? Remember Randy Jackson, the judge? He always used to say a number of things, but one thing he always talked about is, okay, dogs, we gotta keep it real. The best way to manage public expectations is to keep it real. Or in the parlance of today's spin doctors, don't resort to alternate facts. If you align the expectations of your constituents with reality, You're never going to be disappointed, and they're never going to be disappointed.
So how do you keep expectations at an attainable level? Does anybody have any ideas? How might you manage those expectations and keep them? What you really want to do is you want to ensure that you are under-promising and over-delivering, okay? So make sure that what you are telling members of the public, you can actually follow through on. And so one of the ways to do that, I mean, I imagine that you get asked questions on a daily basis from the members of the public. You know, will our local government replace this playground because our playgrounds are aging? If I purchase this property, will the local government rezone it for commercial use? You know, you're facing these questions from members of the public all the time. And if you don't know that there's a policy in place to address that particular issue, then what you want to do is you want to check with your CAO and find out, does your local government have a policy to address the situation, that particular situation, okay? And if there is a policy in place, then you want to find out what that policy is. And then you can answer the question to the member of the public and say, well, you know what, we've got a policy, and this is what it is, and we're going to follow the policy. And if your local government doesn't have a policy, then you want to tell the member of the member of the public, you know what, we will consider the process for getting a policy in place to deal with this.
So why are policies important? And actually, what we're going to get to is spelling policy with a capital P, because there's often confusion about what the difference between a policy and a practice is, and we'll tell you a couple of stories about that. Oh, and the other thing we did when we carefully checked the registrants is we made sure that none of the stories you hear today have anything to do with anybody in the room. We were a little worried because two of our potential stories, there were actually at least two potential stories from the same local government. And we were like, oh my God, let's make sure that they're not there, and they're not, so we're fine. But why are policies important? I think that's good because I've told you, that's your get out of jail free card. And the reason is because they encapsulate all the things that goes into decision making. One of the things that people like me and your CAOs learn early is that a board or a council can only speak with one voice. You all go in with your perspectives and your attitudes, and you've campaigned on certain things, and you make your positions known, but then you vote. And council can't do anything without a vote. It's the only way it can do anything. And once it makes that decision, that's the decision. You might not agree with it, but that's the decision. And you don't have to go out and tell people you agree with it, but what you probably have to do is explain to people, that's the decision. I didn't agree with it because there were certain policy values that I thought should have been done better, but I lost. But if we want to change that, these are the policy considerations you've got to convince the other people about. It sounds quite dispassionate, but that's the reality of policies. And if you could be talking at that level, well, you're actually making a good step towards not taking it personally, which makes it a little easier to deal with the reality of things. But policies are important because not only the policy itself represents the decision, but talking in terms of the policy brings you to a discussion level that's meaningful and in an area that you can actually deal with even if you don't agree with them.
So the word, I mean, let's get back to what is a policy, because this word gets thrown around quite a bit. We've got a policy for that, or what's your policy on X? And when we talk about the word policy, we're not talking about what sort of maybe commonly referred to as a policy. We're not talking about, you know, this is our general practice in the department or in our local government that we all kind of have in our heads and we roughly follow. This isn't my usual, you know, we're not talking about your usual practice. We're not talking about an operational guideline or a procedure. Those may, in fact, be policies, and you call them something different. But what we're talking about is the real legal construct of the policy and how the courts have defined it in terms of the policy defense. So there's a Supreme Court of Canada case called Just in British Columbia. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Canada recognized that governments in Canada have a very special defense available to them. And that's the policy defense, meaning that if they make decisions in accordance and consider a number of factors that Tom's going to talk about in a moment, then those decisions cannot be reviewable by the court. So even if someone suffers a loss because of that decision, the local government won't necessarily be held liable or won't be held liable. So then you say, okay, well, what is a policy? And the policy, the courts have defined a policy is a level of service to be provided by municipal staff or regional district staff that is determined by elected officials and or management, okay? So now, as lawyers, sometimes we will try and craft arguments and argue that basically anything is a policy. But to have a really defensible policy, you need to have a few things in place.
I just on a personal note, with her last two contributions, you've seen two of the reasons why Megan's so good at her job. She has more degrees than my youngest daughter. And believe me, I spent a lot of time buying my youngest daughter degrees. Megan has a master's of education, which means she had to have the bachelor's before that, which is why she first gave you the opportunity to offer some suggestions, because that's what teachers do when they try to engage people. And then she's also a lawyer in practice defending our members for quite a few years before she came to work for us, which is why she just casually slipped in a Supreme Court of Canada decision during breakfast. And you'll notice when she did that, she did that in a way that is uniquely Canadian, because she said the case was Just and British Columbia. Now, whenever you see those cases written, it's written the name of the plaintiff and then the Latin abbreviation VS, period, and then the defendant. And in Canada, we always contract the VS that instead of being versus, we just, lawyers just say and, just and British Columbia. And in the US, where lawyers are attorneys, they just get rid of the S and just call it a V, and they would call it just V British Columbia. So there, you've learned a little bit about Megan and why she's so good at the job. And a little bit, now you can tell a Canadian lawyer from an American lawyer, right? A Canadian lawyer will say they're a lawyer, an American lawyer will say, I'm an attorney and I pronounce versus V. So, now what makes a true policy decision? This is where we get down to why it's so critical to you. Anything that outlines a level of service or an activity or a program that involves weighing financial considerations, economic considerations, social or political factors or constraints is a policy. And there's a couple of real important points here to make. That's what you guys do. That's your job. And it's very important to understand that the courts will defer to you about that. If you're making a political decision, nobody is going to interfere with your ability to make a political decision. So call it a political decision. I don't agree with that. That doesn't fit with my political philosophy. I think it's better to do something else. Very valid thing to do, and you are the only person as an elected official that has the ability, in the eyes of the law, to make those decisions. You're trying to balance a budget, and you don't know what to do about it. And you discuss it. I mean, one of the most simple, common policies is, how often do we inspect sidewalks? Some local governments have a staff and they have tools and equipment and very precise schedules for when sidewalks are to be inspected and when they're, what defects are supposed to be repaired and in what timeline. Other local governments have a policy of, we don't do inspections. We wait till somebody complains about a problem and then we go deal with it. And you know what the courts say about those two policies? Nothing. They enforce them both because they involve weighing those political, economic, allocation of resource factors. Our biggest member, the city of Richmond, has a sidewalk inspection policy of waiting for a complaint. Perfectly valid policy. The courts have said so whenever they've been given the opportunity. And when people sue our members and there's a good defense like that, we're always happy to give the court the opportunity to issue another decision saying that that's a very valid policy. So you have wide latitude in that. The only time a court, there's only two times a court is going to interfere with your policy decision-making process. One is when you exercise bad faith. And I'm not going to ruin your breakfast by talking about bad faith because you're all nice Canadian people and you would never do such a thing. And two is if the decision comes to you and you decide not to make a decision. See, that's the other thing the courts will do. If the decision comes to you and you can say yes or you can say no, or you can say maybe, the court's going to say, fine, nobody could criticize you. But if you just want to kick the can down the road, now that could be criticized because that's not a policy decision. It's not a decision at all. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to make a decision without enough information or investigation, but it does mean at some point you have to make a decision. Now, there are policies are made in a ton of different ways and at many different levels of your organization. And there's good ways to make policy and record policy and bad ways. And Megan's going to tell you what the gold standard for policy making is.
So this is sort of the best chance that you're going to have a defensible policy, is you want a few elements in place. So first of all, you want a policy that's in writing. Now, I will tell you there is some case law that we love to pull out at the MIABC when we're defending claims that says that you can't have a valid policy defense with an unwritten policy. The problem with an unwritten policy, though, is that it's very difficult to prove that it's an actual policy, that everybody knows what the policy is and that everybody's following the policy because it's unwritten. So if you have a written policy, it's clearly, it's there, it's clear and easy to follow. So the second thing is, has it been approved by management or council? And Tom talked about some of the factors that you need to consider that make it a true policy decision. And really, senior management or council are the ones that have the authority to allocate resources, right? So if you know you are considering how to allocate your resources in the creation of that policy, you have the authority to do that as elected officials or as senior management, and therefore it's more likely going to be a bona fide policy or a true policy. You also, one of the key aspects of the policy defense is that you have to be able to follow the policy. So for instance, we have, we have members that might set very high policy for sewer flushing and say, you know what, we're going to flush all our sewer lines 3 times a year. And that's their policy, and there's a sewer backup because there was a clog in the sewer, and we go and we look at the documents, and we find out the sewer line hasn't been flushed in 5 years. But the policy says 3 times a year. So we go to the Public Works Department, we say, well, your policy says this, but you haven't flushed the sewer line for 5 years. Why is that? Well, we just don't have the resources. We just don't have the time. That's okay. You know, you've chosen to allocate those resources somewhere else in local government, and that's your political prerogative. The problem is your policy doesn't reflect that. And so if that claim went to court, the judge would say, you don't have a policy defense because you had this great policy, and yet you didn't follow it. You didn't flush your sewer lines for 5 years. So you need to make sure that you're achieving your policy or that service level that you're setting. And what do you do if you can't achieve it? Change it. Right. It's pretty simple. And then you want to make sure that policy is clear and easy to follow because You, as elected officials and senior management, you're setting the policy, but you're not necessarily the ones. You will follow the policy in some circumstances, but often it's staff that's actually executing the policy. So you need to make sure that it's a policy that staff can actually follow.
Okay, now we're going to tell you some stories. This is the part people always like best. So they like hearing the stories of how other people got in trouble, and we have confirmed that in this case it is other people that have got in trouble. And there's nothing better than learning from somebody else's mistake. Ed, you might think it's hard to find these examples, but what really is tough is actually to reduce them down to three or four that we can talk to you about. As I was leaving the office yesterday, Scott Morishita, one of our staff lawyers, said, "What are you up to tomorrow?" And I told him what Megan and I were doing. And he says, "Oh, that should be fun." He says, "People misuse policies all the time." He says, "I just got it." He's literally points to his desk. He says, "I got this case, and it's a sidewalk, a slip and fall on a sidewalk, and the public works director sent me their policy, and it was great." And so I sat down with the public works foreman to talk about it, because he's got to give evidence about how they implemented this sidewalk inspection case. And I gave him a copy of the policy the public works director gave me, and the foreman picked it up, looked at it, and said, "Where the heck did you get this?" And I wish it weren't true, but that's an actual active file. Megan's got one. We're not going to pick on staff or politicians, so we're going to tell equal number stories about both.
Because it does happen with both. So, so the first story I have to tell you involves three adjacent homes that were built in the 1980s in this particular local government. And the property that these three homes were situated on, when we looked at aerial photographs from the 1940s, there was a large drainage swale that crossed the three properties. And then in about the 1960s, 1970s, the drainage swale was filled in by lots of fun things like soil and gravel and building materials. Garbage. And in the 1980s, these three homes were built on this property. Now, about 20 years later, the homes started to settle and the foundation started cracking, which I'm sure you all know can be very expensive to repair and can be very concerning for homeowners. So when this happened, the homeowners filed a claim. And the MIBC took on the claim to defend the claim. And during the last election cycle, these homeowners went and met with the current mayor and councillor to discuss their concerns about the claim. So the mayor, who's now the mayor, and the councillor, who now the councillor, as part of their election promise, promised these three homeowners that they would be made whole. Now, the issue with that is that they had an insurance policy, and the MIBC was defending the claim. And the policy with respect to settling claims is that we don't settle claims unless there's liability exposure. So unless we see that there's a real risk that the local government is going to be found liable, that they did something that was negligent, we don't pay the claims. And so, these three homes were, it was a little bit different. When we went back and looked at the files, the first home, we looked at the building file. And so when a building is built on a filled-in drainage swale, what do you think you would ask for from the developer? If you're going to build a home on soil, a geotechnical report. So we looked at the building file, and there was no geotechnical report. So we had some liability exposure there. The second home, though, there was a geotechnical report from a certified geotechnical engineer that said, this soil is fine to build on. So we said, great, we've got a good defense on the middle home. Interestingly enough, the third home adjacent to the middle home was built a year later by the same builder on similar soils and didn't have a geotechnical engineer. So we thought, okay, we've got exposure on the two homes, so we'll settle that, but this middle home, we're not going to settle. And but because the homeowners had very high expectations because they had been promised by the mayor and councilor that they would be made whole. They put intense political pressure on council to settle this claim. And what ended up happening is council elected to purchase the claim from the plaintiff, made that homeowner whole, and then took on the cost of pursuing the engineer who was the one that was liable in that particular case. And so the local government wasn't able to necessarily rely on their insurance policy in that case. We did contribute, I think, some, but certainly the local government took the hit on that one.
One of the problems that happened there was the three homeowners, after the talk with the mayor and the councilor, all made a pact that none of them would settle unless all of them settled. So the two that had good claims wound up not getting paid out because they had made an agreement with the one that didn't have a good claim. So these things can spin out of control fairly quickly. The second story I'm going to tell you about is actually, as you know, I've got to go back to the Trump part. For those of you that believe in climate change, I say as it's snowing for like the fifth time this winter in the Lower Mainland. Yeah, it's like Canada came for Christmas and won't go home. The problem we've got on a practical level with climate change is, and we're seeing it all over the province, are these more intense storms, very intense rainfall events. Like even this year, the expectation was with a La Nina year that we were going to have our normal amount of rainfall, or I guess precipitation, but it would be a far fewer events, so they'd be much more concentrated. And what that does with your infrastructure, much of which was built in the 50s and 60s and 70s, when the expectations of what their capacity would have to be were much lower. And so we get these big weather events and you have frequent times where your storm sewers get overwhelmed and they can't take away the excess water and it occasionally will flood private property. And so what a lot of local governments have been doing over the last few years is they've been updating their subdivision and development bylaws that call for bigger capacity storm sewers. All very logical, except our hero in this case, who was he was a drainage engineer in the Public Works Department for our member. He interpreted the new subdivision bylaw as a new policy. Wasn't a new policy that going forward all new subdivisions would have higher capacity storm sewers. His view was what council had done is declared that all storm sewers in the city had to meet the new standards. As you can imagine, you don't have to be a very big city before that becomes a very, very big undertaking and almost impossible to do. But our hero felt he was actually on a bit of a mission with this. He thought council had made the decision and he was going to hold their feet to the fire. So every time there was a flood on somebody's property, the call would come to his desk because he was responsible for the storm sewer system, and he would tell the plaintiffs, I know it's terrible. We have a policy that our storm sewer should be designed to this criteria, and that one just hasn't been upgraded yet. And these, as you might expect, made these cases somewhat difficult for us to defend, and they made them very awkward for, well, this fellow's boss, the superintendent of public works, who didn't actually believe this was a policy. We had a number of claims that we're still dealing with respect to this because the members of the public have been told this by a middle management person in the city, and now they think the city's trying to cover up for not doing what this fellow. We had some very intense discussions with this fellow and his boss and their municipal lawyer, and our lawyers, and I can tell you that he decided ultimately to find a career in a, his future was freed up for him. But the legacy remains, where we have, and that's just somebody at the wrong level of the organization misinterpreting what a policy was. And so this is why it's very important to properly pass the policy, but also make clear not just to members of the public or council or even senior management, but everybody involved in administering the policy, what the policy actually is.
So our last example involves a lovely waterfront piece of property that a developer wanted to develop. And when he approached council, and in particular the mayor of this local government, he said, well, I'd love to develop this this waterfront property. And one of the things I really need and is essential is to get public access over a railway line. And the mayor thought this was a fabulous idea, and this was really going to be the plume in this mayor's cap. Having this development and this available for the public. And he said he had a close relationship with the body that oversaw the railway line and assured the developer, yes, public access won't be a problem. Now, the local government had a policy in place for how to obtain public access and hadn't actually gone through that policy yet to secure the public access. So what do you think happened? Never got the public access, right? And the developer had purchased the property relying on that representation that public access would be secured. And so the developer sued the local government saying, I lost a substantial amount of money. What was the amount of the claim that the developer was claiming?
It was over $30 million.
Over $30 million. Because he was claiming not only for the cost of the property, but also his lost opportunity. We ended up settling that claim for $1.1 million, which was an excellent result, because we knew our liability exposure better, or our case better than the plaintiff actually knew their case. But that's a good example of in raising those expectations of members of the public, in this case a developer, and not knowing or not following a policy that's in place that can actually result in a real claim.
We are going to get done on time, but I think it would not be inappropriate to take some of the BC Assessments Authority time anyway. So just touching on what Megan said, next to your fire chiefs, these development cases are becoming more and more common, and they're getting bigger and bigger. And the reason for that is, as most of you know who have traveled here, there's very little beautiful, flat land with a view and water access left for developers to develop. But that does not stop the appetite for the development industry to want to develop land. And so they are bringing more and more riskier and riskier proposals to your planning departments every day for developing property that probably can't be developed. And what happens is they start putting pressure on your planners, and they start putting pressure on you because they're, quote, getting the runaround. And they want to talk with you. And you might remember, if you were at our session last year, the one thing that you can do to avoid being that mayor and getting personally sued for $30 million, and he was so... which scared the heck out of him because he was about to retire. But the one thing you can do to avoid that is never, ever, ever meet a developer for a cup of coffee in a white spot. We've had three claims that arose from a cup of coffee between a developer and an elected official in a white spot, and I do not believe that the white spot franchise had any stake in any of the claims. But you get involved with these developers want to hear one thing, and I know we don't have official municipal political parties in BC, but we have two unofficial ones, the pro-development political party and the we got to preserve things, keep our character of our town political party. And they're called different things in different places, and they take turns taking power in different places. But what happens is that you get, especially the pro-development political party can get a little exuberant with wanting to encourage economic development. And when your planners start saying they need geotechnical evaluations of property and they need investigations and other things, that's not because they want to. I know planners are the most powerful people in our society today, but that's not because they're exercising their power and trying to give people the runaround. It's because British Columbia is a very, very difficult place to safely build things on. And every region has its challenges, and all the easy stuff is gone. And so I guarantee you, you're gonna be given the opportunity to have a cup of coffee with a developer who's been given the runaround by the bureaucrats in your planning department. And yeah, to quote the former First Lady, just say no. And so, why are policies important? Well, because that's what you do, and you're the only people that have the right to do some of these things. They limit your legal risk that makes us happy and should make you happy, but from your personal selfish perception, they limit your political and reputational risk. And your elected officials, God bless you, we need you. You play a really important part in our local governments and our communities of BC, and you can't do that with a poor reputation or a bad political strategy. And so they're your way to get out of jail free card, not just from lawsuits, but it's your way to get out of jail free from any sort of attack on your reputation or your political career. And I'd love to tell you that we got time for questions, but no, those darn assessing people are here to take the floor. But Megan and I will hang around for a couple of minutes, and if you have anything you want to talk to us about, we'd be happy to talk to you.
Thank you, Tom and Megan, for your presentation on policy Trump spin. In your short presentation, I think, Tom, you've taken us a long way toward making insurance great again. We certainly appreciate you taking the time to be here with us this morning. It was very informative. I'd also like to take a moment to thank MIA for its ongoing support of the LGLA. This morning's breakfast was jointly sponsored by MIA BC and the BC Assessment Authority. And MIA BC is both a founding partner and strong supporter of the LGLA. So once again, thanks very much, Tom and Megan.